Tavis Smiley, and I'm glad to have you hanging around with us today. What an amazing first hour, and looking forward to two more amazing hours today. Some great conversations lined up. In our third and final hour today, we'll be joined by jazz master Terrence Blanchard. He has made the list this year of the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, their jazz master's list. That's a high honor, and we'll celebrate that. We'll talk about the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival and talk about his Grammy-award-winning opera, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. When Terrence Blanchard joins us, this jazz master is he, in our third and final hour today. But in this hour, two more conversations on the B side of this hour. We'll be joined live in studio by UCLA's Dr. Marcus Anthony Hunter to talk about a letter that you might have read about. It made a lot of news, a letter signed by over 400 lawmakers, activists, actors, and more, calling on President Biden to support a list of congressional bills on racial equity and reparative justice through executive actions and orders. As I said earlier, full transparency, I am one of the persons, one of the 400-plus people who agreed to affix their signature to the letter. So we'll talk about the letter, what it says, what it's asking or demanding of this particular president, with Dr. Marcus Anthony Hunter of UCLA, who joins us live in studio in about 30 minutes or less. But we commence this hour with another guest who's been on this program and glad to have her back, University of San Diego Dean Kimberly White-Smith. On ways we can all support our neurodivergent fellow citizens as part of Autism Awareness Month. Dean Kimberly White-Smith, good to have you back. How are you today?
Oh, I'm great. How are you doing? Thank you so much for having me.
I am well. If I complained, I'd be an ingrate. I am doing well and delighted to have you back on the program. Let me start with this big word that I used a moment ago. I always want to make sure there are two things that are always in my mind with every conversation. For all the decades I've been doing this on television and radio, I never want to make the assumption that everybody knows exactly what the guest and I are talking about, and I never want to insult anybody's intelligence. I don't want to talk down to the audience. I don't want to talk over their head. So it's a balancing act every single day, and that's a big word when we refer to people as neurodivergent. What does that mean?
Absolutely. So neurodiversity actually captures the different ways that our brains work. And when we talk about someone who is neurodivergent, we're talking about someone who learns differently than what usual expectations are, like in a classroom or in a workspace. So, for instance, people who are on the autism spectrum, people with ADHD, ADD, dyslexia, dyscalculia, all of those diagnoses would fall under neurodiversity and neurodivergent thinking.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Is there any, let me swing out here. I don't know that there is. I want to ask it because this is your lane. You're the expert. Is there any racial component, any racial element that we are aware of when it comes to neurodiversity?
I'm so glad you asked that because this is the aspect of neurodiversity and autism that really doesn't get talked about. But the intersection of gender, race, and autism is hardly spoken about. Autistic women, and particularly those from BIPOC backgrounds, are often overlooked in research. And so when we think of an autistic person, you tend to think about a white male, right? Mm-hmm. But did you know that for every three men that are autistic, there are four women? And then when we look at the gender aspects, our Black girls are underrepresented in this aspect 80%. So when you think about Black women, you also have to understand that they're very good at masking the symptoms of autism. So many of our women, they go out into the world and they mask these symptoms. And they lean into things such as cooking, things that are culturally acceptable, but they still have auditory processing issues, touch sensitivities. Many of our girls have touch sensitivities. Think about that. In a world where people continuously want to touch our Black girls, so they're double marginalized.
Mm. I want to talk more about the Black angle here in just a second. Let me just back up one more time and ask this. Give me a better understanding of the source, why it is that so many fellow citizens are being diagnosed these days as autistic. From whence does autism come?
So, thinking about kind of the underpinnings of this, it goes back many years. And I am an expert in how teaching and learning happens in the classroom and understanding autism as a function of that and neurodiversity as a function of that. I'm not a historian of the disorder, but it's something I've been in classrooms since 1994, and it's something that we've been discussing since before my time in the classroom. And so this goes back many years, but I will tell you it is historically something that is only recognized within white boys. Yeah. When I go into schools and to communities and classrooms where they recognize these individuals, they give them additional support. They put them in specialized classes where their genius is recognized and elevated. It isn't our black boys and girls. It's not our Latinx boys and girls. It's not our indigenous boys and girls. And so this is something I want to elevate.
Well, we'll talk about that. We'll elevate. I promise you, we will elevate that. We will elevate it and amplify it when we come forward with Dean Kimberly White-Smith on Tavis Smiley.
Hope, agency, dignity. This is Tavis Smiley.
Can you dig it?
Come on!
Who do you trust to get at the truth?
Tavis Smiley.
That's who. The conversation continues right now.
It does indeed with University of San Diego Dean Kimberly White-Smith as we talk about the ways that all of us can support our fellow neurodivergent citizens as part of Autism Awareness Month. We were talking moments ago, though, and I want to come right back to that, about why it is, and no naivete here, but why it is that black boys and black girls are not being included in this conversation in ways that they should. I know a number of people who are doing some really righteous work and heavy lifting to change that narrative. I just saw Holly Robinson, Pete, and Rodney Pete a few days ago, in fact. There are others who I know, Reva Martin, one of my colleagues on my station in Los Angeles. So there are a lot of people I know who are in this space who are doing some really, really righteous work in this regard. Again, so no naivete here, Dr. Kimberly White-Smith, but why is it that we are, why are we left out of this?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because there is evidence that historically, we are left out of the conversation because our children tend to be misdiagnosed in the schooling system. And so even in 2004, Congress recognized the disproportionality of black students in the special education pipeline with diagnoses of social emotional disorder. And these tags or these labels actually speak to behaviors that teachers and principals are seeing from our children in the classroom without any underlying representation of what is really operating or what is really the root cause of their behavior challenges. And so our kids are being misdiagnosed and they're being labeled with these tags that pulls them out of the academic classroom, that does not allow teachers or administrators to have empathy or sympathy for our students. That's why it's so important to have an accurate diagnosis. Now, how do you get that? Well, traditionally, if your parents have the money, they can pay a psychologist or psychiatrist to do the testing and get the label and start getting and demanding that the school system gives their child the supports that they need. If you come from an underrepresented community, if you come from a poor community, under-resourced or an economically oppressed community, you don't have access to those resources. And then you just get caught in this cycle where you have your child labeled social-emotional disorder when that's really not the case.
And how do we, I want to frame this the right way, to the extent that we can, how do we, what are the steps necessary to first stop that mislabeling? Then I got follow-ups. How do we stop the mislabeling? How do we arrest that?
Yeah. Well, you know, the numbers don't lie. If you look at any of the school districts and you pull the numbers of our black kids in special education, you will see the misrepresentation and the mislabeling. It's very apparent. And it's not a secret. What we need to do is band together to demand that these labels be reevaluated and the children with those labels be reevaluated. In California, we didn't even recognize dyslexia until 2018. Yeah. So we have generations of teachers that aren't even trained to work effectively with our students who have dyslexia. And so this is something that we as a community can band together in order to support our students being reassessed. I think that we need to think about the ways in which we as a society can elevate this idea and make our workplaces and our community spaces more radically welcoming to individuals who are neurodivergent or on the autism spectrum.
Yep. I want to be careful now I ask this question because I'm certainly not trying to indict them, but what is the challenge to parents? What is the role of a parent? What is the responsibility of a parent when they think or believe they have a child who has, in fact, been mislabeled, misdiagnosed by the school system?
Mm-hmm. You know, I've been thinking about that a lot because really that's the charge here with our Center for Embodied Equity and Neurodiversity. When we think of individuals who actually experience autism or neurodivergence, it usually in our communities tend to be a double diagnosis. Mm. So they might have a ADHD, but also have some sort of trauma. And so, like I mentioned before, our Black girls are so good at masking the signs of their neurodiversity or their autism that we don't even recognize it. And the things that we tend to scrutinize our Black women about are things that are an innate part of their neurodiversity. And so that's really a critical aspect of us looking at ourselves. What do we recognize as norms? What do we judge our fellow citizens about? What do we look at girls and Black women and criticize them on? These are aspects mm-hmm. of our culture and our community that we need to work on first. We have to put our oxygen mask on first before yeah. we can go out and help anyone else.
I'm never surprised, never shocked at the excellence of Black people, whatever the endeavor might be. And yet I am struck by your reference two or three times now to how brilliant these Black girls are at masking their neurodivergence. Tell me more about how they became such experts at that and what that actually means.
Yeah. So when we think about autism in girls and women, it doesn't show up the same that it does for boys. Mm-hmm. So we tend to think of the impacts with regards to personality, being distant, things of that nature. But it affects different areas in the brains with females. So fine motor skills, executive functioning, emotional regulation are not typically the areas that autism impact our girls. And so these differences kind of help us develop social communication affects that really don't line up with what we typically recognize as autism. So think about our Black girls that perseverate on particular things, right? That perseverate on cooking, that perseverate on other different skills. Think about in the last few years, our Black girls that have been pulled out of the classroom by police mm-hmm. because they did not want to be touched, mm-hmm. right? We need to start thinking more about the underlying symptoms in which we are thinking about our Black women and our Black girls.
Yeah. What is, I'm glad you raised that, what is your indictment, and I'm asking this question broadly, specifically and unapologetically, what is your indictment of the system when it comes to these issues of neurodivergence and the ways in which, my word here, not yours, Black and brown babies are maltreated? To your point, we've all seen these videos. They happen far too often. It seems every other day somebody's posting another one of some Black girl who literally, a baby, who's being arrested by cops and the baby doesn't want to be touched, and it just escalates into the worst kind of horror. And so I ask what your indictment is of the system that allows this to continue to happen.
Absolutely. Well, there's two things operating here. There are gender norms that we as a society put on women specifically, right? So women are supposed to want to have children. They're supposed to want to be touched. They're supposed to want to have this type of intimate connection. They're supposed to like being told that they're attractive. So there's the gender norms, number one, and then that's exacerbated by being Black women, because our Black babies tend to be hyper-sexualized in society. And then the other piece of this is this myth, this cultural myth, these stereotypes about these brilliant autistic white boys and men, right? And as a result of that, our diagnostic tools are normally primarily normed on white males. The majority of autism research is focused on males, and in particular, white males. So there's two aspects to this. One that is a societal gender normalizing of behaviors that actually don't support autistic Black women. And this other aspect of the tools that we have that help us identify our children, our boys, and they're where they are on the autism spectrum, again, aren't created for them.
So let me ask you this. Even if we could succeed, and I pray that in the months and years to come we'll get better at this, and this is what your work and part is all about, even if we can and will ultimately succeed at doing better on the mislabeling of black babies, Black boys and girls, if we progress on the mislabeling issue, is the system ready then to properly serve these kids once they've been properly labeled?
Mm-hmm. I think true progress in this arena definitely means recognizing and dismantling the systemic oppression barriers that doubly marginalize autistic individuals receive, right? Like mm-hmm. our Black and brown babies. So we have to, one, recognize that, but two, we have to recognize the genius and the potential that our Black girls, Black boys, Black women, Black men, bring to the table, right? This idea of, disability, autism, neurodiversity cannot be uncoupled from this fight for our right to academic justice and equity along racialized lines. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is, once we recognize what's going on for them, once we recognize the label, there are definitely embodied approaches that we can utilize and work. Understanding polyvagal theory, understanding how we can really regulate our autonomic systems. These are strategies that we know now work for autistic and neurodivergent learners. And it's part of what Dr. Nikki Elliott here in our Center for Embodied Equity and Neurodiversity does with our school communities and our teachers. We have the know-how. We need to start doing it.
Mm. Since you went there, I want to follow you. I'm watching my time. Got about 3 minutes left here. In this particular moment, given the work that you're doing in your center, what does it mean to be about the business, to have committed yourself to fostering academic justice? That's the phrase, academic justice. What's that mean in this moment, to be fostering academic justice for people who look like you and me?
Absolutely. So for me, social justice doesn't get to what is actually occurring in our schools, in our classrooms, in our communities with our boys and girls. Mm. Academic justice for me, along the lines of what I learned from those social justice leaders and those civil rights leaders from the past, like Bob Moses, who understood that mathematics was a barrier to academic attainment. Mm-hmm. So taking the mislabeling our children leads to pulling them out of academic classes, putting them in spaces where they're learning life skills, living skills, as opposed to the tools of reading, writing, mathematics that they're going to need to be successful later on in life, whether they are developing their skills to work as a craftsman or they're going into higher education. It does not matter. We need to be recognized and we need to understand that we can provide multiple paths for our children. The fact that we've moved away from this idea of developing careers in workspaces where our children can work with their hands is really counterintuitive to what we know about our neurodivergent learners and their ability to work with their hands and to become skilled. And we know in many of these professions that we can make high salaries. So we need to be thinking about that as well. Building, constructing, HVAC, all of those pieces as well.
Yep. Let me close in the 60 seconds I have left by allowing you to do a tribute to the man you referenced a moment ago. I got chill bumps when you mentioned his name. I haven't heard that name in a while. But some years ago, I had the great honor. I met him a number of times. One night, I sat for a 3 or 4 hour dinner with Bob Moses. And it was one of the most amazing nights of my life, just sitting with this American icon, Bob Moses, and all that he did in the Civil Rights era, and then even beyond with his work on mathematics. But just say a quick word about why we should we should call the name of Bob Moses out more frequently.
Many years ago, about 20 years ago, Bob Moses started this movement called Education as a Civil Right. Mm-hmm. He really talked about, and we met several times to discuss the ways in which we as a country are not doing right by our black and brown babies in the education system. Education is not a civil right here in the United States. It is something that each of the states can operate in the way that they so choose. And guess what? It's not even mandated that our babies have pre-K education or education past eighth grade. So what does that mean? We are not centering education.
Nope, I take your point. I'm out of time, and I wish I had more time to talk just about Bob Moses. But there's your assignment for the day. If you've never heard the name Bob Moses or want to learn more about him, just Google Bob Moses and read about this amazing black man and all that he accomplished in his lifetime. For now, we thank Dean Kimberly White Smith for downloading us in this hour about what we can do to support our fellow neurodivergent citizens as part of Autism Awareness Month. Doc, thanks for your work. Good to have you back on this program.
I appreciate you. Good to be back.
Good to have you on. More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward.
What's your quarrel with the world? You're listening to Tavis Smiley.